We kregen een persbericht van Trekt uw plant. Trekt uw plant die samen met een aantal andere organisaties, waarvan hier een paar mensen uit Nederland in de studio zitten ook, een namiddag organiseren vandaag in Elkerik. Om 4:00 is daar de voorstelling van het boek Too High to Fail. Ik ben nu naar een foto in dat boek aan het kijken van een politieman die de hand schudt van een cannabiskweker. En de auteur van dat boek, dat is Doug Fine. Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Welcome in our studio. So, you wrote a book that's called Too High to Fail, and then A New Green Economic Revolution. So, it's about economics, really.
My publisher thinks it's about economics.
Okay, that's a good thing. If I understood correctly, the basic line of the book is that your country has been losing lots of money for 40 years on its wrong attitude towards cannabis and could gain a lot of money with a correct attitude.
Wow, that's the best one-sentence summary that I've heard.
Thank you.
Yeah, ending the
and
war...
And it's correct.
Yes, ending the war on cannabis will be a boon... you know, a good thing for, speaking just in the States, a good thing for public safety and the economy, both of which are important to me as a father.
So the war on drugs, wasn't it started to have more safety? It's not very productive then.
The war on drugs is so unbelievably ill-conceived in every way. Just to give a few examples, again, speaking just for the United States, in 1937, the American Medical Association, still the big doctors group, vigorously opposed the beginning of cannabis prohibition. They thought it was ridiculous because of the medical value of the plant. There was no logic behind beginning the war on cannabis. And I should say that what I write about and what I speak about is just cannabis. There are countries like Portugal which have taken it to what the Dutch call hard and soft drugs, right, and just legalized everything. And I only studied cannabis. And the way that I studied it was I followed one plant from farm to patient in a part of California that had legalized the local sustainable growing of cannabis.
Mm-hmm. So, legalized. I thought that in the USA all drugs are illegal and that cannabis was about the same as heroin. So you have a federal law, but states can do something else.
Right. So this is the big fundamental debate since the beginning of the U.S. is what are the role of the states and what are the role of the federal government? And in fact, that 300-year, you know, nearly 300-year discussion is at the core of why the drug war is ending in the U.S. It's because the right side of the political spectrum is united in a way that is unique. There's no other issue you can talk about this way in the U.S. With the left, they're united in agreement that the drug war must end. Sometimes their reasons don't overlap. The left may be more, may like the plant, let's say, a little bit more themselves for all of the positive things about the cannabis plant, and humans have been interacting and some would argue co-evolving with this plant for 8,000 years. But the left also will talk a lot about prison populations and the terrible public safety offshoots of the war on drugs, creating criminal cartels. The majority of Mexican criminal cartel profits come from cannabis. The right, you hear more about the economic benefits of bringing an untaxed economy into the above-ground economy. But one of the big reasons why it's ending is because there's unity across the political spectrum that the war on drugs is a failure. So the mechanism by which it's happening is... You're correct. We have a federal law called the Controlled Substances Act that classifies cannabis as more dangerous, actually, Schedule 1, than heroin and cocaine, which are Schedule 2, conceived of as having some medical value, and Schedule 1 has no value at all. The insanity of this, right from the beginning of the modern war on drugs, which Richard Nixon declared in 1971. Since then, 1 trillion taxpayers have been devoted to stamping out this plant that people like. 100 million Americans have used it, including the last three presidents. And the war on drugs has had no impact at all. But right from the beginning, in 1972, 1973, federal commissions were coming out saying, cannabis is harmless, it's less dangerous than alcohol, it should be legalized and regulated. There are U.S. federal government agencies that hold patents on medical use of the plant, while officially the policy says no medical use. So this is all getting back to your question of, well, why did this happen? Wasn't it intended to do this or that? There was no logic at all. It was, what it is now is it's a law enforcement bureaucracy. The addicts in the drug war are police agencies that get my taxpayer money, billions per year, to try and, well, to fail at interdicting this, at stopping this plant, this relatively safe plant that's fine to use.
Enough to fail or something like that.
Right.
So you see it as more or less a way to give a job to a lot of people who wouldn't have a job otherwise.
Well, that's how it is now. I mean, we have 8,000 Drug Enforcement Administration agents. That's just federal drug law, and local and state agencies are really banned. And so as for how it's ending, the people realize the truth. The people realize that the mythology created to keep a drug war going is patently false. To give one big important example for me as a father, multiple studies have shown that any place that has in some form legalized cannabis, from American medical states to the entire nation of Portugal, every place, youth use rates go down. There's no been a single study that's contradicted this.
Because young people like to do something that's forbidden.
That's one element, the forbidden fruit element, and the other element I shorthand as criminals don't ask to see your identification and how old you are. I honestly am pleasantly surprised by the consistency of these studies, because as a youth, I remember, in the U.S., the drinking age is 21 for alcohol, and I knew at age 17 in high school ways to get beer. But I guess if alcohol was totally illegal, I would have had more ways, because and it would have been cheaper or something, because I speak at schools and I ask the students, and invariably I'm told that it's easier in the States to get cannabis than alcohol when you're underage. So the actual facts on the ground, the Americans know. As I said, 80% of Americans believe the drug war is a failure. And even in very conservative states, what we call red states in the U.S., Arizona, Kentucky, these states are polling a majority now in favor of ending the drug war, and it's increasing with every poll. So the people realize it, and we have this federal-state quandary, and what we're seeing is one state at a time voting first for medical cannabis. We have 20 of our 50 states have legalized medical cannabis, and two, and growing, have legalized all adult social use of the plant, regulated like alcohol. That's the
like alcohol.
Yeah.
So there is a minimum age.
I believe it's 21 in both Colorado and Washington are the two states. Oregon and several other states are next. And then a big one is going to be California in 2016 is polling for very sort of runaway support for legalization with very little opposition. So really the Berlin Wall of the drug war in the States is down, and that's the message I'm bringing to Europe, which is experiencing the same sea change but in distinct different ways in every country.
Hallelujah. So, but the war on drugs is more than a war on cannabis. So you say the war on drugs should end, but there still should be a different policy for cannabis and other drugs.
Yeah, because it's so silly that we even have this term drugs and drug policy when, in one hand, you're lumping cannabis in with truly dangerous things like meth and heroin, and on the other hand, you're not including the number one addiction, which is alcohol, and now with prescription pill abuse, that mixture is really dangerous and toxic. So to even use this word drug policy is a little bit of a misnomer. But again, the levels of use are so different. For instance, in the States, cannabis is by far the number one cash crop. In the county that I followed, Mendocino County, California, beautiful North Coast, redwood trees, beautiful county. For three generations, the crop is the number one by far crop has been cannabis, to the tune of $6 billion U.S. dollars to farmers every year, most of it untaxed to this point, although I followed the effort, local efforts to legalize. So to answer your question, everything else put together is not only a minimal amount of the percentage of use in the U.S. If you're talking about illegal drugs today like heroin and cocaine and methamphetamine, minuscule compared to cannabis. Also, the majority of taxpayer dollars and resources are going to stifle cannabis, and the majority of illegal criminal enterprise profits come from cannabis. So I feel fairly safe, at least in the U.S., when I say ending the war on drugs and making it equal to ending the war on cannabis, that's the vast majority of it. You could take away 29 of the $30 billion that taxpayers like me pay every year for the drug war, and in that last billion, you could not only genuinely fight the dangerous drugs, but implement treatment for people that have issues with anything, cannabis, pills, alcohol, and true education in schools of what the real dangers are of various possibilities for intoxication and why one should wait till one's body is fully formed before using any of them. And you would cut out the hugest percentage of criminal enterprises. Legalizing cannabis.
It's quite a different approach. But then, of course, there's one effect of the whole war on drugs that has been bringing profit to a group of people, and that's private prisons. So wouldn't you deprive those people of a lot of cheap work labor by introducing your policy?
One of the things that gets me really angry as a patriotic American is the revolving door between government agencies and private industry in general. It just is a kind of corruption, and it's something that's not okay, and one day we're going to address it as a nation. Basic things, maybe 12 years between a government job and private industry seems like a fair amount of time, something along those lines. And today it's shocking. So if listeners today are right now have their laptops in front of them or their phones, and they Google, do an internet search, revolving door U.S. Marshals Service private prison industry, the federal agency that manages private prison, but federal prisons rather, the Marshals Service, basically there's this one lady who has gone back and forth between running the oversight to running the companies to running the oversight. And this is common in our a lot of our federal agencies, namely those that regulate food and drug administration, going to pharmaceutical companies, all that kind of stuff.
So the policy is written by people who have an economic interest in those prisons.
And when you say economic interest, it's like winning the lottery. It's millions of dollars of salary immediately just because of your influence and past job. And the reason why this matters is that you're having private prisons with very politically well-connected people negotiating not just on the federal level but with municipalities saying, we will charge you per prisoner lower than you pay now to operate the prisons. We'll undersell your costs, so we'll save you money. All we ask in return is that you guarantee 95% incarceration rates. That's been in contracts. So even sort of right-wing people are coming forward and saying, this is not a way, this is not a winning, so this is not a country out to win. This is a bunch of thieves trying to be parasitic. In Too High to Fail, in the book, I did go and cover the justice system and how it affects people. You know, that since the modern war on drugs has started, the U.S. is, we call ourselves the land of the free, and we've become the most incarcerated nation in history. Several hundred thousand more than China has in prison today, and a great percentage of that is nonviolent drug offenders. 2.3 million Americans in prison today.
Yes, you have the country with the highest percentage of the population in prison, I think, and by far. In the statistics, it's really amazing.
More than Russia, yeah. Although, on the other hand, we do have these really nice license plates because the prisoners make the license plates, so no problem with the license plates.
So that's a good thing about the war on drugs, then. Nice license plates. In your book, you are talking about the good uses of cannabis, and you seem to have said somewhere that you can even see energy independence for your country in legalizing cannabis.
That's the biggest thing.
That's the biggest thing,
yeah.
Yes. Sounds
so
nice.
So I'm wearing a hemp shirt and hemp pants and the
yes,
industrial
you look
side.
Nice, yes.
Thank you.
And a hemp pant?
Just the band. Okay. The band on that on this Panama hat is the I think it's straw, the rest of it. But so the deal is already, we already discussed cannabis is the biggest cash crop in North America. I wouldn't be surprised if that's also true in Europe, but I only did the research in the U.S. So psychoactive cannabis, social, spiritual, medicinal cannabis is the biggest crop in North America. I believe that industrial cannabis in 10 years' time will be even bigger than that. And the metaphor is Heineken is big, but Shell is bigger. And the mode is one of two ways of generating energy. It comes from the otherwise unusable herd, the stalks of the hemp plant, or cannabis, both industrial and psychoactive cannabis. You're not using the sticks, basically, right? So you can either ferment them, ethanol, create alcohol that way, or the big Germany and Austria are leading the way on this in biomass combustion, low carbon footprint through this gasification process of super high heating plant material of any kind. It doesn't have to be cannabis. But in Too High to Fail, the farmers were so ahead of the curve that they were thinking about, in this great legalization experiment I wrote about, getting together in centralized facilities, which solves a whole bunch of problems. the flower trimming process of cannabis is a risky one while federal prohibition exists, because you're hiring people off the street, paying them under the table as they trim the flowers and prepare them for what's known as bag appeal, readiness for the patient or the customer. So they wanted to do this in a centralized way where payroll would be taken care of by accountants. Then scientists could come in and do the testing. First of all, making sure it's safe and free of molds, pesticides, mildew, but also examining its cannabinoid profile. And for listeners who don't know, we have this endocannabinoid system in our body, and it's why cannabis is being shown to have such varied medical benefits, from ending epileptic seizures to, in some types of cases, cytotoxicity, reversing tumors, in cancerous tumors, as well as things that we laugh about, like the munchies, makes you hungry. Well, for a cancer patient, that's life-saving. So testing for the profile and which medicinal qualities that plants have, this is what the Emerald Triangle, as they call this region that I studied in California, the emerald growers, they wanted to get together and do this so that all the product, all the harvest was tested in one area. But then you're left with all these stocks. So from there, how about a municipal, countywide, regional energy facility that creates energy independence for cannabis cultivation or hemp cultivation communities? This could work in Belgium. This could work everywhere. It's a modular system of energy independence and local jobs and local profit from sustainable cannabis farming. It's like the hippies were right. Save the world through cannabis.
But now those people are called ganjapreneur, apparently. Beautiful word.
Or sensimillionaires, that's the other one.
Great. Now, you talk about scientists looking at the stuff and determining if it's good or what quality it is. And then we come maybe to the green part of the revolution. You have all those producers, and apparently now the producers are rather small-scale, independent people. But then, of course, if there is big money in it, then you get also big corporations smelling this money and wanting to get in. So I read an article about Monsanto wanting to take over the market.
Well, first of all, bless those Canadians. They have a prophylactic ban on genetically modified hemp in Canada, even though it doesn't exist yet. And I just think that was a very far-sighted, wonderful thing the Canadians did. Do you know what I'm saying? That genetically modified cannabis is already banned in Canada, is what I'm saying. Which is a really magical, great decision that they did back in 1996. So my view on the market future of cannabis, at least on the psychoactive end, is this. Wall Street does what Wall Street does. You know what I mean? Does that translate Wall Street? Just big business is going to do what big business is going to do. So we'll see in the late night, all night market that sells crap beer and crap tobacco, there'll be a package of crap joints made by whomever, Marlboro or whoever. But in the U.S. at least, we have a $10 billion a year craft beer market where more and more people are interested in who made this beer, what are the ingredients in it. Cannabis already is like that. It's a decentralized, farmer-centric, producer-centric industry where if the consumer can be educated that, and this is the farmers that I followed are doing this, they're branding themselves like Champagne and Parmesan, regions that brand themselves. They're calling themselves the Emerald Growers Association and putting this stamp of approval where it has this nice story. When the legalization comes, we've been farmers for three generations. This is the special flowers we ourselves enjoy. You know, our family trims it right to your door kind of story, like you'd have in a fine wine or in a fine beer. So there will be an economic shakeup after legalization. That's just a fact. But the producers that are serious about it, the people equivalent to great makers of fine cheese or fine wine, they're going to have their niche market that is going to survive and thrive after prohibition ends. But yes, big business is also going to come in. It's why when I talk about the drug war, for me what victory entails, when I can just say, done, take off this hat, go on to the next project, is when I know that in the U.S., or I guess I should say worldwide, people can cultivate a reasonable amount of cannabis in their own garden. That means that pharmaceutical companies, for instance, are not going to be able to patent seeds, patent the cannabinoid components of the plant, and only one or two, God knows how they're grown, varieties will be available officially from a pharmacy. As long as people can get seeds and put them in the ground, even relatively small numbers of them, I think we, the people, will have won the drug peace, as I like to think of it. And really, I bring good news. We're almost there in the U.S. There are rooms for so many different models to make sure that local producers thrive. And the Belgian model that's underway right now is one of the most exciting things I've seen anywhere in the world.
Tell us about it. What's so exciting about it?
So right now, what's happening in Belgium is the social club model, not just in Belgium. It's happening in Spain, and they're trying in other places like England. And the basic deal is, I'm smiling here in the studio because what I've been told is you Belgians know how to find loopholes in, okay?
And
okay, so good. I'm glad that I'm not spreading a false stereotype. And basically the deal is not the law, but the guidelines on drug policy in Belgium allow one plant per person. Basically, you're basically safe legally. So there's all kinds of nuance that all people that understand how Belgium work can talk about. But that's basically how the law is being interpreted. So the social club model is setting up along those lines. People that themselves can't cultivate, but that are responsible adults who choose the safer choice than alcohol, incidentally, cannabis, for either social or medicinal or spiritual use. So we have several active now. You started here in Antwerp, Trek to Plant. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Trek uw plant. En niet zoals in een mailtje van Elkrik per ongeluk stond, trek uw plat. Dat is iets helemaal... Yes, that's a word game.
But the name itself is a word game of sort of, in English we would say, pull yourself up by your britches or by your bootstraps, do it yourself, and no one else is going to do it for you, which is kind of a nice concept. So you've started this thing, bless them, I think they've got 300-something members, and I think it's working well. We'll talk more about it today. But the one that I've been watching very closely is the really wonderful growth curve of the Mambo Social Club out of Hasselt. You know, I see Michelle Deegans, who is the founder. His email is servers crashing from all the people that want to be part of this. Belgians like their medicine too, as they say. Everybody, humanity appears to like this plant. And Belgians are finding a clever and sustainable way. And I think in the French part of the country, there's a couple of young guys that are doing it as well. I'm watching it not only with great interest, but with great support. It seems to be a very responsible way to operate within sort of the Belgian modus operandi.
Okay, thank you for the compliment. I think we have to stop here. The next program is ready to start. One last question. Are you planning to visit Uruguay?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. God bless the Uruguayans and their wonderful sort of low-key president.
Who is living a bit like you are living, if I understood correctly.
That's right. I am a solar-powered goat rancher. If people want more information about me or my work, they can go to dougfine.com.